San Diego. I'd buy some Mexicans to clean it every day. I'd buy Canadians, but they're all friggin' lazy. That's where the hippies went when W won the day. I will rule the world forever. I'm straight and white and male, American and free.
Condoleezza, check my pussy.
Clarence Thomas, Halliburton, mass destruction me. Is a lovely place to visit. My wife would love to go there every single year. But they're just puppies.
Yep, 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 yep.
They need to stick their yips. The big dogs over here. I will rule the world forever. I'm straight and white and male, American and free.
Condoleezza, check my pussy.
Bill O'Reilly, Devolt Systems, mass destruction me. My country loves to lend a hand to folks like me. I will rule the world forever. I'm straight and white and male, American and free.
Condoleezza, check my pussy.
Jerry Falwell, Coors Foundation, mass destruction me.
In his 1959 novel, Lord of the Flies, author William Golding tells a tale of a group of English schoolboys marooned on a deserted island as a result of a plane crash that kills all the adults. Over time, the boys descend into murderous rivalry and barbarism as forces of, quote, anarchy, represented by one group of boys dressed in black, overcome the blonde-haired leader, son of a British Navy commander, representing the order of British society. The book echoes the themes from the Century of Self, of a belief that barbaric forces lurk inside people and must be held in check by the structures of our civilization. The Lord of the Flies is taught in high school literature classes, and I suppose for this reason, the web is full of sites instructing teachers and students how to think about this book. Here is an excerpt of an analysis from one of those sites, novelguide.com. Quote, Golding narrates, "Eyes shining, mouths open, triumphant, they savored the right of domination. They were lifted up, were friends." Here the reader feels a genuine sense of hope that the boys, despite their differences, will ultimately get along and cooperatively find a mode of rescue. Golding concludes his first chapter with an eerie foreshadowing, when he details the near killing of a pig which the trio discovers on the trail. Jack is especially enamored by the pig, feeling a creeping desire to slay it with his knife. Yet Jack's anarchist hunting influence hasn't had sufficient time to conquer the voice of reason articulated by Piggy. All three boys are afraid of actually taking the life of a living thing. Golding articulates their feelings, saying, quote, they knew very well why he hadn't, because of the enormity of the knife descending and cutting into living flesh, because of the unbearable blood. Soon, Jack's attitude will change when the desire to kill transcends the necessity to obey. Close quote. That analysis from the online teaching guide, novelguide.com. The murderous pack mentality, the competition to rule, which Golding attributes to basic human nature and the novel guide attributes to anarchy, is in fact at the essence of what children are socialized into, not out of, in our schools. It is in the primary school experience that children are taught to have teams and captains and line monitors and to compete with other students for position in school society, if they have not already experienced a home life with similar dynamics. They learn to ostracize and persecute those singled out by adults or peers for humiliation or exclusion. Last week, in our reading from former teacher John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, we ended with Gatto's observation that, quote, the strongest meshes of the school net are invisible. Constant bidding for a stranger's attention creates a chemistry producing the common characteristics of modern school children: whining, dishonesty, malice, treachery, cruelty. Unceasing competition for official favor in the dramatic fishbowl of a classroom delivers cowardly children, little people sunk in chronic boredom, little people with no apparent purpose for being alive. The full significance of the classroom as a dramatic environment, as primarily a dramatic environment, has never been properly acknowledged or examined. The most destructive dynamic is identical to that which causes caged rats to develop eccentric or even violent mannerisms when they press a bar for sustenance on an aperiodic reinforcement schedule, one where food is delivered at random, but the rat doesn't suspect. Much of the weird behavior school kids display is a function of the aperiodic reinforcement schedule, and the endless confinement and inactivity to slowly drive children out of their minds. Trapped children, like trapped rats, need close management. Any rat psychologist will tell you that. And now we continue further into Chapter 2, titled An Angry Look at Modern Schooling, from the Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. In the first decades of the 20th century, a small group of soon-to-be-famous academics, symbolically led by John Dewey and Edward Thorndike of Columbia Teachers College, Elwood P. Cubberley of Stanford, G. Stanley Hall of Clark, and an ambitious handful of others, energized and financed by major corporate and financial allies like Morgan, Astor, Whitney, Carnegie, and Rockefeller, decided to bend government schooling to the service of business and the political state, as it had been done a century before in Prussia. Cubberley delicately voiced what was happening this way, quote, the nature of the national need must determine the character of the education provided, close quote. National need, of course, depends upon point of view. The NEA in 1930 sharpened our understanding by specifying in a resolution of its Department of Superintendents what school served was an effective use of capital, quote unquote, through which our, quote, unprecedented wealth-producing power has been gained. When you look beyond the rhetoric of left and right, pronouncements like this mark the degree to which the organs of schooling had been transplanted into the corporate body of the new economy. It's important to keep in mind that no harm was meant by any designers or managers of this great project. It was only the law of nature as they perceived it. working progressively as capitalism itself did for the ultimate good of all. The real force behind school effort came from true believers of many persuasions, linked together mainly by their belief that family and church were retrograde institutions standing in the way of progress. Far beyond the myriad practical details and economic considerations, there existed a kind of grail quest, an idea capable of catching the imagination of dreamers and firing the blood of zealots. The entire academic community here and abroad had been Darwinized and Galtonized by this time, and to this contingent, school seemed an instrument of managing evolutionary destiny. In Thorndike's memorable words, conditions for controlled selective breeding had to be set up before the new American industrial proletariat took things into their own hands, quote unquote. America was a frustrating petri dish in which to cultivate a managerial revolution, however, because of its historic freedom traditions. But thanks to the patronage of important men and institutions, a group of academics were able to visit mainland China to launch a modernization project known as the New Thought Tide. Dewey himself lived in China for 2 years, where the pedagogical theories were inculcated in the Young Turk elements, then tested on a bewildered population which had recently been stripped of its ancient form of governance. A similar process was embedded in the new Russian state during the 1920s. While American public opinion was unaware of this undertaking, some big city school superintendents were wise to the fact that they were part of a global experiment. Listen to H.B. Wilson, superintendent of the Topeka schools, quote, "The introduction of the American school into the Orient has broken up 40 centuries of conservatism. It has given us a new China, a new Japan, and is working marked progress in Turkey and the Philippines. The schools are in a position to determine the lines of progress." Motivation of Schoolwork, 1916. Thoughts like this don't spring full-blown from the heads of men like Dr. Wilson of Topeka. They have to be planted there. The Western-inspired and Western-financed Chinese Revolution, following hard on the heels of the last desperate attempt by China to prevent the British government traffic in narcotic drugs there, placed that ancient province in a favorable state for laboratory tests of mind alteration technology. Out of this period rose a Chinese universal tracking procedure called the Dangan, a continuous lifelong personnel file exposing every student's intimate life history from birth through school and onwards. The Dangan constituted the ultimate overthrow of privacy. Today, nobody works in China without a Dangan. By the mid-1960s, preliminary work on an American Dangan was underway as information reservoirs attached to the school institution began to store personal information. A new class of expert, like Ralph Tyler of the Carnegie Endowments, quietly began to urge collection of personal data from students and its unification in computer code to enhance cross-referencing. Surreptitious data gathering was justified by Tyler as the moral right of institutions. Between 1896 and 1920, a small group of industrialists and financiers, together with their private charitable foundations, subsidized university chairs, university researchers, and school administrators, spent more money on forced schooling than the government itself did. Carnegie and Rockefeller, as late as 1915, were spending more themselves. In this laissez-faire fashion, a system of modern schooling was constructed without public participation. The motives for this are undoubtedly mixed, but it will be useful for you to hear a few excerpts from the first mission statement of Rockefeller's General Education Board, as they occur in a document called Occasional Letter No. 1 from 1906. Quote, "In our dreams, people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. The present educational conventions, intellectual and character education, fade from our minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or men of science. We have not to raise up from among them authors, educators, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians, nor lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of whom we have ample supply. The task we set before ourselves is very simple. We will organize children and teach them to do in a perfect way the things their fathers and mothers are doing in an imperfect way. This mission statement will reward multiple re-readings. And I'm reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. And we continue. By 1971, the U.S. Office of Education was deeply committed to accessing private lives and thoughts of children. In that year, it granted contracts for 7 volumes of Change Agent Studies to the Rand Corporation. Change Agent training was launched with federal funding under the Education Professions Development Act. In time, the fascinating volume, Change Agent's Guide to Innovation in Education, appeared, following which grants were awarded to teacher training programs for the development of change agents. 6 more RAND manuals were subsequently distributed, enlarging the scope of change agentry. In 1973, Catherine Barrett, president of the National Education Association, said, quote, "Dramatic changes in the way we raise our children are indicated, particularly in terms of schooling. We will be agents of change." Close quote. By 1989, a senior director of the Mid-Continent Regional Educational Laboratory told the 50 governors of American states that year assembled to discuss government schooling, quote, "What we're into is total restructuring of society." Close quote. It doesn't get much plainer than that. There is no record of a single governor objecting. 2 years later, Gerald Bracey, a leading professional promoter of government schooling, wrote in his annual report to clients, quote, "We must continue to produce an uneducated social class." Close quote. Overproduction was the bogey of industrialists in 1900. A century later, underproduction, made possible by dumbed-down schooling, still had to keep that disease in check. The crude power and resources to make 20th century forced schooling happen as it did came from large corporations and the federal government, from powerful loan-established families, and from the universities, now swollen with recruits from the declining Protestant ministry and from once clerical families. All this is easy enough to trace once you know it's there. But the soul of the thing was far more complex, an amalgam of ancient religious doctrine, utopian philosophy, and European-Asiatic strong state politics mixed together and distilled. The great facade behind which this was happening was a new enlightenment. Scientific scholarship, in league with German research values brought to America in the last half of the 19th century. Modern German tradition always assigned universities the primary task of serving industry and the political state. But that was a radical contradiction of American tradition to serve the individual and the family. Indiana University provides a sharp insight into the kind of science fictional consciousness developing outside the mostly irrelevant debate conducted in the press about schooling, a debate proceeding on early 19th century lines. By 1900, a special discipline existed in Indiana for elite students, bionomics. Invitees were handpicked by college president David Starr Jordan, who created and taught the course. It dealt with the why and how of producing a new evolutionary ruling class. Although that characterization, suggesting as it does kings, dukes, and princes, is somewhat misleading. In the new scientific era dawning, the ruling class were those managers trained in the goals and procedures of new systems. Jordan did so well at Bionomics, he was soon invited into the major leagues of university existence, an invitation extended personally by rail tycoon Leland Stanford, to become first president of Stanford University, a school inspired by Andrew Carnegie's famous Gospel of Wealth essay. Jordan remained president of Stanford for 30 years. Bionomics acquired its direct link with forced schooling in a fortuitous fashion. When he left Indiana, Jordan eventually reached back to get his star Bionomics protege, Elwood P. Cubberley, to become dean of teacher education at Stanford. In this heady position, young Cubberley made himself a reigning aristocrat of the new institution. He wrote a history of American schooling, which became the standard of the school business for the next 50 years. He assembled a national syndicate which controlled administrative posts from coast to coast. Cubberley was the man to see, the kingmaker in American school life, until its pattern was set in stone. Did the abstract and rather arcane discipline of Bionomics have any effect on real life? Well, consider this. The first formal legislation making forced sterilization a legal act on planet Earth was passed, not in Germany or Japan, but in the American state of Indiana, a law which became official in the famous 1927 Supreme Court test case Buck v. Bell. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote the majority opinion allowing 17-year-old Carrie Buck to be sterilized against her will to prevent her degenerate offspring, in Holmes' words, from being born. 20 years after the momentous decision, in the trial of German doctors at Nuremberg, Nazi physicians testified that their precedents were American, aimed at combating racial degeneracy. The German name for forced sterilization was the Indiana procedure. To say this bionomical spirit infected public schooling is only to say birds fly. Once you know it's there, the principle jumps out at you from behind every school bush. It suffused public discourse in many areas where it had claimed superior insight. Walter Lippmann, in 1922, demanded, quote, severe restrictions on public debate in light of the allegedly enormous number of feeble-minded Americans. The old idea of participatory democracy was insane, according to Lippmann. The theme of scientifically controlled breeding interacted in a complex way with the old Prussian ideal of a logical society run by experts loyal to the state. It also echoed the idea of British state religion and political society that God himself had appointed the social classes. What gradually began to emerge from this was a Darwinian, caste-based American version of institutional schooling, remote-controlled at long distance, administered through a growing army of hired hands, layered into intricate pedagogical hierarchies, on the old Roman principle of divide and conquer. Meanwhile, in the larger world, assisted mightily by intense concentration of ownership in the new electronic media, developments moved swiftly also. In 1928, Edward L. Bernays, godfather of the new craft of spin control we call public relations, told the readers of his book Crystallizing Public Opinion that invisible power was now in control of every aspect of American life. Democracy, said Bernays, was only a front for skillful wire-pulling. The necessary know-how to pull these crucial wires was available for sale to businessmen and policy people. Public imagination was controlled by shaping the minds of school children. By 1944, a repudiation of Jefferson's idea that mankind had natural rights was resonating in every corner of academic life. Any professor who expected free money from foundations, corporations, or government agencies had to play the scientific management string on his lute. In 1961, the concept of the political state as the sovereign principle surfaced dramatically in John F. Kennedy's famous inaugural address, in which his national audience was lectured, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." 35 years later, Kennedy's lofty Romanized rhetoric and metaphor were replaced by the tough-talking, wise-guy idiom of time, instructing its readers in a 1996 cover story that democracy is in the worst interest of national goals. As Time reporters put it, the modern world is too complex to allow the man or woman in the street to interfere in its management. Close quote. Democracy was deemed a system for losers. To a public desensitized to its rights and possibilities, frozen out of the national debate, to a public whose fate was in the hands of experts, the secret was in the open for those who could read the entrails. The original American ideals had been repudiated by their guardians. School was best seen from this new perspective as the critical terminal on a production line to create a utopia resembling Epcot Center, but with one important bionomical limitation. It wasn't intended for everyone, at least not for very long, this utopia. Out of Johns Hopkins in 1996 came this chilling news, quote, "The American economy has grown massively since the mid-1960s, but workers' real spendable wages are no higher than they were 30 years ago." That from a book called Fat and Mean, about the significance of corporate downsizing. During the boom economy of the 1980s and 1990s, purchasing power rose for 20% of the population and actually declined 13% for the other four-fifths. Indeed, after inflation was factored in, purchasing power of a working couple in 1995 was only 8% greater than for a single working man in 1905. This steep decline in common prosperity over 90 years forced both parents from home and deposited kids in the management systems of daycare, extended schooling, and commercial entertainment. Despite the century-long harangue that schooling was the cure for unevenly spread wealth, exactly the reverse occurred. Wealth was 250% more concentrated at the century's end than at its beginning. I don't mean to be inflammatory, but it's as if government schooling made people dumber, not brighter, made families weaker, not stronger, ruined formal religion with its hard-sell exclusion of God, set the class structure in stone by dividing children into classes and setting them against one another, and has been midwife to an alarming concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a fraction of the national community. Throughout most of my long school career, I woke up angry in the morning, went through the school day angry, went to sleep angry at night. Anger was the fuel that drove me to spend 30 years trying to master this destructive institution. And I'm reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto.
I've listened to all of your nonsense. I've tried to make sense of it. It's left me broken, bleeding, slow burn American rage. I take the hours they give me. My wife sleeps all alone. My son, he barely knows me. I am
American Red!
My father sweared oil in a flat field. My mother taught children in school. We fought and saved and prayed. We bleed American rage. I work every second I'm breathing.
clock, every second I'm alive. But still I'm slowly sinking. I am
American
Now we begin Chapter 3, Eyeless in Gaza. Something strange has been going on in government schools, especially where the matter of reading is concerned. Abundant data exists to show that by 1840, the incidence of complex literacy in the United States was between 93 and 100%, wherever such a thing mattered. Yet compulsory schooling existed nowhere. Between the two world wars, schoolmen seem to have been assigned the task of terminating our universal reading proficiency. The deeds were monstrous, but the doer, Adolf Eichmann, was quite ordinary, commonplace, and neither demonic nor monstrous. There was no sign in him of firm ideological convictions or specific evil motives, and the only notable characteristic one could detect in his past behavior, as well as in his behavior during the trial, was something entirely negative. It was not stupidity, but thoughtlessness. Might not the problem of good and evil, our faculty for telling right from wrong, be connected with our faculty for thought? That quote from Hannah Arendt, The Life of the Mind. And Gatto continues, I always knew school books and real books were different. Most kids do. But I remained vague on any particular grounds for my prejudice until one day, tired of the simple-minded junior high school English curriculum, I decided to teach Moby Dick to eighth-grade classes. A friendly assistant principal smuggled a school edition into the book purchases, and we were able to weigh anchor the next fall. What a book! Ishmael, the young seaman who relates Melville's tale, is a half-orphan by decree of fate, sentenced never to know a natural home again. But Ahab is no accidental victim. He has consciously willed his own exile from a young wife and child, from the fruits of his wealth, and from earth itself in order to pursue his vocation of getting even. Revenge on the natural order is what drives him. War against God and family. To me, it defines the essence of Americanness. It's no accident that America's three classic novels, Moby Dick, The Scarlet Letter, and Huckleberry Finn, each deal with ambiguous families, or that each emerges from a time not far from either side of the Civil War. America had been an inferno for families, as Melville, Hawthorne, and Twain all knew. Midway through our first full century as a nation, the nearly universal American experience of homelessness found its voice. Ishmael is a half-orphan. Ahab, an absentee father and husband. The harpooners, expatriate men of color. Pearl, a bastard. Hester, an adulteress. The Reverend Dimmesdale, a sexual predator and runaway father. Huck Finn, de facto, an adoptee. Jim, a twice-uprooted African slave. When we think what our schools became, we need to recall what a great pile of us are homeless. We long for homes we can never have, as long as we have institutions like school, television, corporation, and government in loco parentis. Patricia Lines of the U.S. Department of Education, in trying honorably to discuss what the rank and file of homeschoolers actually do, finally declared it seems to be wrapped up closely with a feeling of intense interest in the life of the community, close quote. Above anything else, she found loyalty in the warp and woof of family. Homeschoolers are tremendously loyal as family members. They are suspicious of television and other less intimate influences. They eat as a family. They socialize as a family. They attend church as a family. They become members of an extended homeschooling community. American Great Fiction is about individuals broken from family. The closest they come to satisfying the universal yearning is a struggle for surrogates, like the strange connection between Pearl, Hester, and the Dark Forest. America's most fascinating storytellers focus on the hollowness of American public life. We have no place to go when work is done. Our inner life, long extinguished, our public work in remaking the world can never be done because personal homework isn't available to us. There's no institutional solace for this malady. In outrage at our lonely fate, we lay siege to the family sanctuary wherever it survives, as Ahab lay siege to the seas for his accursed whale. For this and other reasons long lost, I decided to teach Moby Dick to my 8th grade classes, including the dumb ones. I discovered right away that the white whale was just too big for 45-minute bell breaks. I couldn't divide it comfortably to fit the schedule. Melville's book is too vast to say just what the right way to teach it really is. It speaks to every reader privately. To grapple with it demanded elastic time, not the fixed bell breaks of junior high. Indeed, it offered so many choices of purpose, some aesthetic, some historical, some social, some philosophical, some theological, some dramatic, some economic, that compelling the attention of a room full of young people to any one aspect seemed willful and arbitrary. Soon after I began teaching Moby Dick, I realized the school edition wasn't a real book, but a kind of disguised indoctrination providing all the questions, a scientific addition to the original text designed to make the book teacher-proof and student-proof. If you even read those questions, let alone answered them, there would be no chance ever again for a private exchange between you and Melville. The invisible editor would have preempted it. The editors of the school edition provided a package of prefabricated questions and more than 100 chapter-by-chapter abstracts and interpretations of their own. Many teachers considered this a gift. It does the thinking for them. If I didn't assign these questions, kids wanted to know why not. Their parents wanted to know why not. Unless everyone duly parroted the party line set down by the book editor, children used to getting high marks became scared and angry. The school text of Moby Dick had been subtly denatured. Worse than useless, it was actually dangerous. So I pitched it out and bought a set of undoctored books with my own money. The school edition of Moby Dick asked all the right questions, so I had to throw it away. Real books don't do that. Real books demand people actively participate by asking their own questions, Books that show you the best questions to ask aren't just stupid. They hurt the mind under the guise of helping it, exactly the way standardized tests do. Real books, unlike school books, can't be standardized. They are eccentric. No book fits everyone. If you think about it, schooled people, like school books, are much alike. Some folks find that desirable for economic reasons. The discipline organizing our economy and our politics derive from mathematical and interpretive exercises, the accuracy of which depends upon customers being much alike and very predictable. People who read too many books get quirky. We can't have too much eccentricity, or it would bankrupt us. Market research depends on people behaving as if they were alike. It doesn't matter whether they are or not. One way to see the difference between school books and real books like Moby Dick is to examine different procedures which separate librarians, the custodians of real books, from school teachers, the custodians of school books. To begin with, libraries are usually comfortable, clean, and quiet. They are orderly places where you can actually read instead of just pretending to read. For some reason, libraries are never age segregated, nor do they presume to segregate readers by questionable tests of ability any more than farms or forests or oceans do. The librarian doesn't tell me what to read, doesn't tell me what sequence of reading I have to follow, doesn't grade my reading. The librarian trusts me to have a worthwhile purpose of my own. I appreciate that, and trust the library in return. Some other significant differences between libraries and schools. The librarian lets me ask my own questions and helps me when I want help, not when she decides I need it. If I feel like reading all day long, that's okay with the librarian, who doesn't compel me to stop at intervals by ringing a bell in my ear. The library keeps its nose out of my home. It doesn't send letters to my family, nor does it issue orders on how I should use my reading time at home. The library doesn't play favorites. It's a democratic place, as seems proper in a democracy. If the books I want are available, I get them, even if that decision deprives someone more gifted and talented than I am. The library never humiliates me by posting ranked lists of good readers. It presumes good reading is its own reward and doesn't need to be held up as an object lesson to bad readers. One of the strangest differences between a library and a school is that you almost never see a kid behaving badly in a library. The library never makes predictions about my future based on my past reading habits. It tolerates eccentric reading because it realizes free men and women are often very eccentric. Finally, the library has real books, not school books. I know the Moby Dick I find in the library won't have questions at the end of the chapter or be scientifically Baudelaireized. Library books are not written by collective pens. At least not yet. Real books conform to the private curriculum of each author, not to the invisible curriculum of a corporate bureaucracy. Real books transport us to an inner realm of solitude and unmonitored mental reflection in a way school books and computer programs can't. If they were not devoid of such capacity, they would jeopardize school routines devised to control behavior. Real books conform to the private curriculum of particular authors, not to the demands of bureaucracy. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. At the start of World War II, millions of men showed up at registration offices to take low-level academic tests before being inducted. The years of maximum mobilization were 1942 to 1944. The fighting force had been mostly schooled in the 1930s, both those inducted and those turned away. Of the 18 million men who were tested, 17,280,000 of them were judged to have the minimum competence in reading required to be a soldier, a 96% literacy rate. Although this was a 2% fall off from the 98% among voluntary military applicants 10 years earlier, the dip was so small it didn't worry anybody. World War II was over in 1945. 6 years later, another war began in Korea. Several million men were tested for military service, but this time 600,000 were rejected. Literacy in the draft pool had dropped to 81%, even though all that was needed to classify a soldier as literate was fourth grade reading proficiency. In the few short years from the beginning of World War II to Korea, a terrifying problem of adult illiteracy had appeared. The Korean War Group received most of its schooling in the 1940s, and it had more years in school with more professionally trained personnel and more scientifically selected textbooks than the World War II men, yet it could not read, write, count, speak, or think, as well as the earlier, less schooled contingent. A third American war began in the mid-1960s. By its end in 1973, the number of men found non-inductible by reason of inability to read safety instructions, interpret road signs, decipher orders, and so on, in other words, the number found illiterate, had reached 27% of the total pool. Vietnam-era young men had been schooled in the 1950s and the 1960s, much better schooled than either of the two earlier groups. But the 4% illiteracy of 1941, which had transmuted into the 19% illiteracy of 1952, had now grown into the 27% illiteracy of 1970. Not only had the fraction of competent readers dropped to 73%, but a substantial chunk of even those were only barely adequate. They could not keep abreast of developments by reading a newspaper. They could not read for pleasure. They could not sustain a thought or an argument. They could not write well enough to manage their own affairs without assistance. Consider how much more compelling the steady progression of intellectual blindness is when we track it through Army admission tests rather than college admission scores and standardized reading tests, which inflate apparent proficiency by frequently changing the way the tests are scored. Looking back, abundant data exists from states like Connecticut and Massachusetts to show that by 1840, the incidence of complex literacy in the United States was between 93 and 100%, wherever such a thing mattered. According to the Connecticut Census of 1840, only one citizen out of every 579 was illiterate. And you probably don't want to know, not really, what people in those days considered illiterate. It's too embarrassing. Popular novels of the period give a clue. Last of the Mohicans, published in 1826, sold so well that a contemporary equivalent would have to move 10 million copies to match it. If you pick up an uncut version, you find yourself in a dense thicket of philosophy, history, culture, manners, politics, geography, analysis of human motives and actions, all conveyed in data-rich, periodic sentences so formidable that only a determined and well-educated reader can handle it nowadays. Yet in 1818, we were a small farm nation without colleges or universities to speak of. Could those simple folk have had more complex minds than our own? By 1940, the literacy figure for all states stood at 96% for whites, 80% for blacks. Notice that for all the disadvantages blacks labored under, 4 of 5 were nevertheless literate. 6 decades later, at the end of the 20th century, the National Adult Literacy Survey and the National Assessment of Educational Progress say 40% of blacks and 17% of whites can't read at all. Put another way, black illiteracy doubled, white illiteracy quadrupled. Before you think of anything else in regard to these numbers, think of this. We spend 3 to 4 times as much real money on schooling as we did 60 years ago. But 60 years ago, virtually everyone, black or white, could read. In their famous bestseller, The Bell Curve, prominent social analysts Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein say that what we're seeing are the results of selective breeding in society. Smart people naturally get together with smart people, dumb people with dumb people. As they have children generation after generation, the differences between the groups gets larger and larger. That sounds plausible, and the authors produce impressive mathematics to prove their case. But their documentation shows that they are entirely ignorant of the military data available to challenge their contention. The terrifying drop in literacy between World War II and Korea happened in a decade, and even the brashest survival of the fittest theorist wouldn't argue evolution unfolds that way. The Bell Curve writers say black illiteracy and violence is genetically programmed, but like many academics, they ignore contradictory evidence. For example, on the matter of violence inscribed in black genes, the inconvenient parallel is to South Africa, where 31 million blacks live, the same count as living in the United States. Compare numbers of blacks who died by violence in South Africa in civil war conditions during 1989, 1990, and 1991 with our own peacetime mortality statistics, and you find that far from exceeding the violent death toll in the United States or even matching it, South Africa had proportionately less than 1/4 the violent death rate of American blacks. If more contemporary comparisons are sought, we need only to compare the current black literacy rate in the United States, 56%, with the rate in Jamaica, 98.5%, a figure considerably higher than the American white literacy rate, 83%. If not heredity, what then? Well, one change is indisputable, well-documented, and easy to track. During World War II, American public schools massively converted to non-phonetic ways of teaching reading. On the matter of violence alone, this would seem to have impact. According to the Justice Department, 80% of the incarcerated violent criminal population is illiterate or nearly so, and 67% of all criminals locked up. There seems to be a direct connection between the humiliation poor readers experience and the life of angry criminals. As reading ability plummeted in America after World War II, crime soared, so did out-of-wedlock births, which doubled in the 1950s and doubled again in the 1960s, when bizarre violence for the first time became commonplace in daily life. When literacy was first abandoned as a primary goal by schools, white people were in a better position than black people because they inherited a 300-year-old American tradition of learning to read at home by matching spoken sound with letters. Thus, home assistance was able to correct the deficiencies of dumbed-down schools for whites. But black people had been forbidden to learn to read under slavery, and as late as 1930 only averaged 3 to 4 years of schooling. So they were helpless when teachers suddenly stopped teaching children to read, since they had no fallback position. Not helpless because of genetic inferiority, but because they had to trust school authorities to a much greater extent than white people. Back in 1952, the Army quietly began hiring hundreds of psychologists to find out how 600,000 high school graduates had successfully faked illiteracy. Regna Wood sums up the episode this way. After the psychologists told the officers that the graduates weren't faking, Defense Department administrators knew that something terrible had happened in grade school reading instruction, and they knew it had started in the 30s. Why they remained silent, no one knows. The switch back to reading instruction that worked for everyone should have been made then, but it wasn't. In 1882, fifth graders read these authors in their Appleton school reader: William Shakespeare, Henry Thoreau, George Washington, Sir Walter Scott, Mark Twain, Benjamin Franklin, Oliver Wendell Holmes, John Bunyan, Daniel Webster, Samuel Johnson, Lewis Carroll, Thomas Jefferson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and others like them. In 1995, a student teacher of fifth graders in Minneapolis wrote to the local newspaper, quote, "I was told children are not to be expected to spell the following words correctly. Back, big, call, came, can, day, did, dog, down, get, good, have, he, home, if, in, it, is, like, little, man, morning, mother, my, night, off, out, over, people, play, ran, said, saw, she, some, soon, them, their, time. 2. Up, us, very, water, we, went, where, when, will, would, etc. Is this nuts?" And I'm reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. Do you think class size, teacher compensation, and school revenue have much to do with education quality? If so, the conclusion is inescapable that we are living in a golden age. From 1955 to 1991, the U.S. pupil-teacher ratio dropped 40%. The average salary of teachers rose 50% in real terms. And the annual expense per pupil, inflation-adjusted, soared 350%. What other hypothesis, then, might fit the strange data I'm about to present? Forget the 10% drop in SAT and achievement test scores the press beats to death with regularity. How do you explain the 37% decline since 1972 in students who score above 600 on the SAT? This is an absolute decline, not a relative one. It is not affected by an increase in unsuitable minds taking the test, or by an increase in the numbers. The absolute body count of smart students is down drastically, with the test no more difficult than yesterday's, but considerably less so. And I've been reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. Gatto spent 30 years as an award-winning teacher in the New York City public schools. In his mid-50s, he resigned in disillusion with his role in an education process that he believes hurts children and has degraded the mentality and character of the nation. Gatto is a nationally known advocate of self-directed education and homeschooling of children. For more on his work, visit johntaylorgatto.com. That's Gatto with two T's. Music by The Majestic 12 was featured in this week's program. Find them on the web at themajestic12.com. And our theme music, The Unwelcome Guest, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie and music by Billy Bragg, was, this week, a live concert version performed by Billy Bragg. Thank you for listening.
As we trot in this dark here, if robbing the rich is for worse or for best, they take it by stealing, by lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black best. I treat horses good, and I'm friendly to strangers. I ride and you're running, makes my guns talk the best. The rangers and deputies are hired by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shiny black best. Yes, they'll catch me napping one day, and they'll will kill me, and then I'll be gone. But it won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle will always be filled, sir, by unwelcome travelers and other brave men. And they'll take the money and spread it out equal, just like in the Bible and the prophets suggest. But the men that go riding to help these poor workers, the rich will cut down like an unwelcome guest.